From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Peter Heinlein, VOA correspondent who reported extensively on the Horn of Africa from Addis Ababa. Pete also served as VOA correspondent at the United Nations, as well as VOA bureau chief in Moscow and New Delhi. Our topic on this edition of the program, the Horn of Africa, al-Shabaab's growing terror, and is reclusive Eritrea turning a page? Our guest, Bronwyn Brewton. She is deputy director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. That's a respected think tank here in Washington. Bronwyn is a recognized authority on the conflict in Somalia. Her articles and editorials on the Horn of Africa in general are regularly featured in Foreign Affairs, The New York Times, and Foreign Policy magazine. She recently returned from a trip to Eritrea, a country which is subject to two UN Security Council sanctions resolutions for allegedly providing support to armed groups undermining peace and reconciliation in Somalia. The United States established diplomatic relations with Eritrea in 1993 following its independence and separation from Ethiopia. The United States supported Eritrea's independence, but ongoing government detention of political dissidents and others, the closure of the independent press, limits on civil liberties, and Eritrea's failure to accept a proposed U.S. ambassador have strained U.S.-Eritrean relations. Eritrea's authoritarian regime is controlled entirely by the president, Isaias Afwerki, who heads the sole political party which has ruled the country since 1991. National elections have not taken place since that year. Regionally, Eritrea has long-standing border disputes with Ethiopia and Djibouti that in the past turned violent. U.S. interests in Eritrea include reconciling ongoing disputes with Ethiopia and Djibouti, urging progress toward a democratic political culture, citing and addressing human rights issues, promoting economic reform, and encouraging Eritrea to contribute to regional stability. We'll talk with Bronwyn Brewton about her meeting with President Isaias and prospects for, if not reform, then some positive changes inside the reclusive country and an opportunity for reengagement with the United States. And Bronwyn Brewton joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Pete Heinlein.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Carol.
Well, Bronwyn Brewton, by way of talking about Eritrea, let me ask you a question that involves Eritrean refugees. We're reading in the press that about one half of the people on the vessel that drowned crossing the Mediterranean en route to Italy were from Eritrea. Eritreans are second only to Syrians in the number of boat arrivals, even though the country is a fraction of Syria's size and there's no civil war in Eritrea. Please explain.
Let me start off by sort of taking the conventional point of view on Eritrea and telling you that it is regarded as one of the most repressive nations in the world. And the reason that most people leave the country is because there has been an indefinite military conscription underway. Basically, if you are a person between the ages of 18 and 40, you can be called up for national service, which could be military service or it could be digging ditches for a mining company or a development agency. And in the past, since the border war with Ethiopia in 1998, in practice, that service has been indefinite. It was supposed to be for 18 months, but circumstances have forced the government to keep people on for up to 10 years. And youth don't want to do that, and they flee the country. But I have to say, too, that not all the people who claim to be Eritrean refugees are actually Eritrean refugees. When I hear a number of, like, 400 people on a boat, I have to suspect that at least some of those people were actually refugees from other countries, taking advantage of Europe's automatic asylum policy. If you're from Eritrea, or if you can convince a refugee officer that you're from Eritrea, you get an automatic green card in Europe. No questions asked. And that means that Sudanese, Ethiopians, Somalis, everybody has an incentive to walk through this open door from some of the poorest countries in the world to some of the richest countries in the world.
I see. Well, that's a very good point. Now let's go back to the roots of the problem in Eritrea, how it became so authoritarian after independence, the dispute with Ethiopia, before we talk about what you say in some of your writings are potential signs for some positive changes. Discuss the roots of the problem, the dispute particularly between Eritrea and Ethiopia.
Eritrea and Ethiopia, the two ruling parties of Eritrea and Ethiopia, were once the best of friends. Isaias Afwerki and Melissa Nawi were buddies in arms, and they fought against the Derg, and they overthrew the Derg cooperatively. But after the Derg was defeated, differences of opinion developed, particularly over whether Eritrea should be an independent country, and eventually over the demarcation of the common border. And Eritrea and Ethiopia fought a vicious border war in 1998 that killed 30,000 Eritreans. And Eritrea is a country of only 3 million people. It's a small country, so 30,000 people is a pretty significant number. But they fought this vicious border war, at the end of which a international judicial body determined that the border mostly belonged to Eritrea, particularly this very symbolic important town of Badame. And Ethiopia refused to honor the firm and final ruling of the Border Commission and has refused to surrender the Eritrean territory. And so basically what has happened is that there's a situation of no peace, no war. And that's left Eritrea on a situation of high alert, essentially. I also have to emphasize that this border war came after 30 years of conflict over Eritrean independence as well, in which many more people than 30,000 were killed. Some 60,000 people were killed. When I was in Eritrea, I was able to see some of those trenches, World War II style trenches, in which the Eritreans contested this war, and photographs of the horrible things that happened to people as they were fighting. So this is really a shell-shocked nation. This is a nation that has had to fight desperately for its independence and for its autonomy and has never been able to stop fighting. Even now, when I think most people in Eritrea don't believe that a restart of the war with Ethiopia is going to happen, they still feel under siege from economic sanctions, under siege from international censure, under siege from small strikes by Ethiopia. There's a sense that they're still at war.
And I have many more questions, but let me turn to my colleague, Pete Heinlein, who spent years in the region, for a question.
Well, they're still fighting, aren't they? Yes, there's this cold peace, we say, but do you foresee an end to this hostility between Ethiopia, which is now a country of almost 100 million people, and little Eritrea, 3 million? And the Ethiopians, as you know, are quite influential in international circles. And the Eritreans are, as you have said, are not very good at international relations.
And then let me add to that, why does Ethiopia not recognize the internationally demarcated border?
But the short answer to that, Carol, is because they don't have to. Because the United States is the guarantor of that negotiation, and the U.S. has not held Ethiopia to its commitments. Ethiopia is a vital partner in the war on terrorism, and it's really not in Washington's interest to pick a fight with them. And Washington has not done so.
Ethiopia does argue that the ruling was flawed. It's a very complicated and complex relationship. And the Ethiopians really, in their own minds, were absolutely certain that the International Commission would rule in their favor. And they were so caught off guard, they can't accept. And they do have the military power that allows them to stay right there. They're not going to budge. To them, it's a matter of pride. This is sort of Tigrayan, Eritrean pride. And they can't let these guys, this rump faction that they see, win at the negotiating table what they lost on the battlefield.
Very good point, Pete. I appreciate that.
You know, what I found incredibly striking when I was in Eritrea and when I had the opportunity to talk to a lot of senior Eritrean officials, including the president, was how much Eritrea has managed to move forward. And this is something that you never see reflected in the reporting on Eritrea. The incredible focus that they have on the education system, on the healthcare system, on the welfare systems. I mean, they have accepted their isolation, and it's amazing how much they've managed to accomplish in spite of it. And I have to say, I was astonished by the fact that they've been willing to accept that the international community is not going to help them, that the U.S. is not going to change its reliance on Ethiopia, and that they need to carry on in spite of that. And they've done it. They really have done it. And they have a lot of problems, But they deserve some credit for what they have accomplished.
It's interesting because ideologically, Ethiopia and Eritrea are extremely similar. And this ideology gives them the authority to manage their people very carefully and right down to the family level. It's interesting that Eritrea, with 3 million people, is able to do it fairly well. With Ethiopia and 100 million people, it just doesn't work as well, even though the Ethiopians do get a lot of credit for delivering health care and other social services to their people.
You know, I would have to say, too, that Ethiopia gets a lot of credit for holding what a State Department official has recently described as free, fair, and transparent elections. But the last set of elections, the ruling party won 99.6% of the vote, and there's no one in the universe who would call that a democratic outcome, except maybe some people in the State Department. I should qualify that.
Yeah, and I covered that. And the truth is, although they won 99.6% of the seats in parliament, they only won probably 50% of the votes. It's hard really to know, but it's first past the post, so they won all the seats.
We're talking with Bronwyn Brewton. She's deputy director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. That's a prominent think tank here in Washington. She just returned from Eritrea, and we're going to be pursuing a conversation with her about that visit. But first, Bronwyn, talk about these UN Security Council sanctions against Eritrea. Why did the UN impose them, and is it necessary to keep those sanctions on Eritrea?
So Eritrea was sanctioned twice. The first time it was for providing support to the Somali al-Qaeda-linked rebel group, al-Shabaab. You know, I'm a long-standing expert on the Somali conflict, and I traveled in Somalia at the height of the fighting with al-Shabaab in Mogadishu. And I have to say that I've asked a lot of Somalis about whether Eritrea was a key driver of the conflict in Somalia. I've never heard a single one of them say yes.
Yeah, the truth of the matter is they don't have the ability to do very much, even if they wanted to. It's unrealistic to think that they could be a big supporter of the Somali insurgents.
It is, you know, and what's more baffling is that if you ask Somalis whether Ethiopia is the primary driver of the conflict, almost every one of them will say yes. And yet Ethiopia has been lauded for its activities in Somalia, and Eritrea has been sanctioned.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it goes to the extent to which politics have influenced our perception of the conflict in Somalia. In my opinion, there's no grounds for maintaining those sanctions on Eritrea. And I think even the United Nations Monitoring Group would agree with that at this point. They don't have any evidence that Eritrea is supporting al-Shabaab or has in recent years, period.
But Eritrea is a repressive government and to this day continues to be one of the biggest jailers of journalists and prosecutors of journalists. There's no free press and there's very little liberty of any sort that we can see developing in Eritrea.
I can't argue with that. I think that that's true. But I would ask whether the sanctions are doing anything to improve that situation or if they're actually making the situation worse for the average Eritrean person. And in my opinion, sanctions are hurting and not helping.
That's a valid point.
And the sanctions consist of what exactly?
Eritrea is not under an economic embargo, so firms have the right to do business in Eritrea, but there's a heavy due diligence requirement that makes it very difficult for firms to operate there. And there's additional sanctions on Eritrea because it has a 2% income tax that it levies on its diaspora, which is illegal according to international law. And there are separate sanctions for that. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't really talk about the justice. Although I have to say, as an American citizen, when I live overseas, I also pay income taxes to the United States on my income. So it's something that the U.S. also practices. I think actually Eritrea and the United States are the only two countries in the world who do that.
But they do that to citizens who are saying, now I'm a citizen of Canada or the United States. I'm not an Eritrean anymore. But the Eritrean government comes and says to them, you must pay.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Bronwyn Brewton. She's deputy director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, a think tank based in Washington. I'm your host, Carol Castiel, along with former VOA Horn of Africa correspondent Pete Heinlein. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. You can also send feedback via email to pcusa@voanews.com. Either way, tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program. Here's a shout-out to a faithful podcast listener from China, Ten Shodai Jin. Thank you for writing. Well, back to you, Roman Bruton.
Can I circle back really quickly?
Yes.
I think I accept the point that, you know, Eritreans who don't have citizenship shouldn't be expected to pay the 2% tax. But it's a distinction without a difference. When I'm an American and I decide to surrender my citizenship, it's a choice. When Eritreans leave, they do it for economic opportunities. In order to get a green card, they have to say they're oppressed. They have to lose their citizenship. And if you are a member of the Eritrean diaspora and you still consider yourself a citizen at heart, you pay that 2% tax to keep that door open. So it's a way of affirming your citizenship.
Bronwyn, let's go back and find out how you went to Eritrea, who financed the trip, and what prompted you to go, and what did you find? And particularly, how was your audience with President Isaias, and what gives you a sense that perhaps some positive change is in the offing?
So I, you know, have written about the Somali conflict for many years, and the Eritreans have always appreciated my perspective because I've been, I would say, quite objective in analyzing Ethiopia's role in the conflict. And I've never said anything great about Eritrea. I've never been a supporter of that country. But because I've been critical of Ethiopia, the door has been open, and I've had a standing invitation to go for many years. I just decided to do it. So I spoke to the chargé here in Washington and asked if I could go, and he said, absolutely. And it wasn't hard to get a visa. And I understand that Eritrea has a reputation for being closed, but I have not had that experience. It was received warmly in Eritrea. I had a lot of very blunt conversations, including with the president. There were no topics of conversation that were off the table. I asked him about freedom of the press. I made the mistake of asking him about reforms that were taking place, and he didn't like the word reforms very much.
And why is that?
Because in order to reform, you have to have done something wrong.
Which he doesn't admit he has done.
That's right. But, you know, that's a small little thing. I'm putting it out there because it is meaningful in terms of understanding the frame of mind in Eritrea. But what I think is important is that there is a process of change that's going on there. For example, Eritrean officials said that they have stopped the indefinite military conscription policy. They say that they've demobilized quietly, without anyone knowing it, 100,000 people in the last year. They say that only 5% of the people in the program have been there for more than 18 months at this point. And I suspect, although I don't know, these things are very complicated, I suspect that the release of all those people may be one of the things that's driving the outflow of refugees from the country. There's been a significant uptick of more than tripling, I think, of the number of Eritreans who are seeking asylum in the last 12 months. And I suspect that those two events are tied. The Eritreans have, the president specifically, has decided that he's going to restart the process of rewriting the constitution. He's appointed a chairperson to take on that task. I don't think elections are going to be on the cards anytime soon, but the restart of the process is significant, and he described it as the result of a very long process of learning, of evolution that's taken place, and his conviction that Eritrea is at a point now where they can establish a system. They know enough that they can do that. And I think that's a positive development. He certainly affirmed his commitment to equality and human rights. He says those are the foundational principles on which he governs. I mean, you can certainly look at Eritrea's human rights record and find reasons to question that. But I think having a constitution that affirms those principles is a really good start. So it's a reason for hope. There's been a lot of outreach to Europe that's taken place recently. And Eritrea did spontaneously release 6 journalists in January. So there are reasons to think that some good things are happening.
But at the same time, there is not just a lack of democracy, but a rejection of the principles on which many of the Western countries were founded. There's also a religious persecution that's alleged. Have you talked to the president or experienced anything about that?
One of the reasons that I believe so strongly in bringing Eritrea in from the cold and lifting the sanctions and re-engaging is because there's such a lack of opportunity in the country. Nobody has jobs. Nobody gets paid decently. When we talked about the fact that these poor youth conscripts get a pittance for their work, senior officials were quick to point out, you know, we get a pittance for our work. Nobody gets paid decently because we don't have any money. There is nothing but this national project. Nothing. And if there's anything that the Eritreans are terrified of, it's nonconformity. It's nonconformity. And people who are Jehovah's Witnesses, Pentecostal, Baha'is, people who put religion above the state are terrifying. And they've been treated brutally. And there's absolutely no justifying that. But I do think that if Eritrea's economic prospects could be improved, if people could choose between national service and a job, then I think that the situation could get better very rapidly. And I do think that Eritrean officials expressed concern, not remorse necessarily, but concern about the plight of those religious minorities and a desire to do something to fix the situation.
Now, there are always rumors about President Isaias's health. Many people think those are inspired by the Ethiopians. You met him, you spoke to him. How's he doing? Give us a report.
He was very impressive. We sat with the president for almost 3 hours, and he was very, very sharp. I mean, I was very impressed. He was so astute. He was so articulate in English. He didn't miss a beat. And I remember thinking, he really does not look sick. And frankly, he looks 50, and he's a lot older than that.
Bronwyn, what is the status of U.S.-Eritrean relations? And what are the prospects for change?
Well, the status of U.S.-Eritrean relations is it's abysmal. There's really no good contact going on between Eritrean diplomats and American diplomats, even though they have a chargé here and we have a chargé over in Asmara. The thing that I found most disheartening about my trip was, even though I feel convinced that there are plenty of excellent reasons to restart the relations, not least because of the situation in Yemen, right across the Red Sea, this dangerous vacuum in Eritrea is bad for U.S. security interests, very bad. But despite being able to make a very easy case that it's in everybody's interest to improve relations, there's just no confidence on the Eritrean side that the U.S. is interested in that. Basically, the president feels, and I think he's justified in this view, that the U.S. put all of its eggs in the Ethiopian basket and that there's really no possibility for an improvement in the Eritrean relationship until there's a rebalancing of the relationship with Ethiopia.
Sometimes it seems as if countries such as Eritrea find that it's in their interests. The U.S. is the country everybody seems to love to hate sometimes, you know, and it serves their interests to be anti-American. That, oh, yeah, that's the great whatever it is, you know, the great evil. Do you find any of that?
You know, I have to say, and this is only my personal opinion, and I don't represent anyone in this view but myself, I think the Eritreans have a lot to be angry about. Their independence was scuttled by America's persistence in taking Ethiopia's side. And they've had this no peace, no war situation because the U.S. has refused to enforce the ruling of the Border Commission, which, you know, I understand that Ethiopia is not happy with it, but it was firm and final. And sometimes you lose and you have to accept the loss and move on. And Ethiopia hasn't done that and it's not acceptable. And the U.S. is the guarantor of that process and hasn't played its part. And the sanctions, too, I think have been slapped on Eritrea unjustly, at least in the Somali case. And the U.S. is the force that's preventing them from being lifted to the detriment of the Eritrean people. I just don't have any doubt of that. And I think that the anger is pretty justified in this case. And I wish that Washington were a little bit more open to making the first gesture towards repairing relations. I find it very frustrating that we don't see any progress on our side.
And even after your trip, I'm sure you've spoken with people in the government, there's no change of heart in the U.S. government?
I think both sides, both Eritrea and Washington, are holding out for the other side to make the first step. There are a few issues that appear insoluble. I mean, for example, Eritrea has two local employees of the U.S. Embassy in jail. And both sides are saying, you know, the fixation on these two people is unreasonable. The U.S. thinks it's absurd that Eritrea won't let them out to further relations, and Eritrea thinks it's ridiculous that the U.S. is fixated on them when so many people have died and suffered and won't overlook this and move forward. So it's stubbornness on both sides, quite honestly.
Do you see any sign of magnanimity bubbling in the U.S. side?
I think that there is a growing consensus among certainly among people who've been to Eritrea, that the policy is unhelpful and needs to change. I see that. But there are some senior people in the U.S. government who have very strong opinions about Eritrea. Our national security advisor, Susan Rice, for example. And when you have blockages that high on the food chain, it makes it really hard to move forward.
Indeed. And, you know, before we close, Bronwyn, I would like you to talk about the recent terrorist attack by al-Shabaab on Garissa University, the college in northeastern Kenya. You wrote an interesting article in Foreign Policy magazine called Al-Shabaab Crosses the Rubicon. Discuss your observations as a result of this horrific attack. What does this mean for al-Shabaab? How have they transformed? And what does it say about the efforts to try to confront al-Shabaab, defeat them?
You know, al-Shabaab is a very complicated organization. It's had many lives. In its first iteration, it was a small militia attached to the Union of Islamic Courts. Then after the Ethiopian invasion, it became a national resistance movement, and it had a goal of governing Somalia. And because it wanted to govern, it had populist concerns. It had to coexist with the clans. It had to distribute humanitarian relief. It didn't want to be perceived as unreasonably violent. And now, since al-Shabaab has been effectively defeated in Somalia, it's been turned back into a spoiler, marginal guerrilla force. And it's moved into Kenya. It's become an entirely different animal. It doesn't have the populist impulse that it had for many years. It's really a purely terrorist organization. And, you know, looking at the Westgate attack, I think you can say that they were still trying to have a little bit of that populist edge, because Westgate was targeting rich foreigners. It was targeting rich Kenyans in a country where a lot of people feel marginalized and poor. So you could sort of see the populist argument that they might have gone with there.
The Westgate Mall back in
Nairobi.
Yeah.
In
September, yes,
exactly.
of 2013. But with this attack, targeting students, that is as low as you can go. It really is as low as you can go.
And is it a sign of desperation or strength?
In my opinion, it's a sign that al-Shabaab is probably pivoting towards ISIS. They're pivoting away from the old al-Qaeda ideal that you need to be the voice of the grievances of the people, and they're becoming a much more predatory group. They're not interested in gaining allies in the broader Muslim population. They want to get very disenfranchised, angry young men, not necessarily poor young men, but people who are angry, and just a few of them enough to launch these vicious terrorist attacks. So they're a very different group than they were 2 or 3 years ago, or even a year ago in Somalia.
So where do we go from here, Bronwyn, in terms of confronting them? You know, how would you recommend the international community, the region, try to defeat them?
Well, unfortunately, one of the things that they're going to carry over from their Somalia experience is profound ability to take advantage of brutal security forces. So the number one thing that the international community can do is try to get some reform on the part of the Kenyan security forces and Kenyan politicians, who have a habit of conflating the average Somali with your al-Shabaab terrorist. It's not a helpful conversation they're having there.
Seems as if al-Shabaab has learned from ISIS that these horrific beheadings and attacks where they kill innocent people get them positive traction with the group they're trying to recruit.
Yeah, and unfortunately, in my opinion, I thought that the Garissa attack was very directly referential to Boko Haram in Nigeria, and it would being an attack on a school that really is Boko Haram's hallmark. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I think this kind of learning across African terrorist groups is going to be occurring more regularly, and that is a very frightening thing.
Well, let's hope that your cautious optimism about what's going on in Eritrea will bear itself out in the next months, if not years.
What's important here, too, is that, you know, the U.S. is not in the driver's seat for once on this. It's Europe that is really leading the charge when it comes to Eritrea, because Europe has the refugee problem, and they see fixing the situation in Eritrea as vital to their own security interests.
Bronwyn Brewton is Deputy Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, a prominent think tank here in Washington. She recently returned from a trip to Eritrea. Well, Bronwyn Brewton, thank you so much for coming in, sharing your terrific insights.
Thank you for having me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Jackson Witt, and joining me on the program was former VOA Horn of Africa correspondent Pete Heinlein. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.